Welcome to the deep dive today, where we're going over this research paper. And wow, it's really got some fascinating stuff about how social cells really are. Like, who knew?
Yeah, it's really interesting how this paper really kind of throws a wrench into that traditional way of thinking about biology. You know, like everything's separated into these neat little boxes. It's a good reminder that even when you're looking at an organism as seemingly simple as a bacterium, it's still sharing this really deep evolutionary connection with us.
It really is. Like, we're all just part of this one big evolutionary experiment in a way. And by studying even these, you know, simplest organisms, we can learn so much about the fundamental rules that all life is playing by. But the paper makes this other point that's important too, right? That we shouldn't get carried away with making these big generalizations. I mean, just because some molecule or some process exists in one species, it doesn't automatically mean it works the same way somewhere else.
Exactly. We got to watch out for that. You can have homologous molecules across different species, but what they're actually doing, their roles, can be totally different. It highlights how important it is to like really look at the context when we're interpreting these scientific findings, right? And how dangerous it can be to just assume that what we see in one organism translates directly to another without really thinking it through.
It's like saying that a bicycle and a spaceship both have wheels, so they must be following the same rules of physics, you know? Clearly, context is everything. So how do these little, I guess you could call them single-celled socialites, how do they manage to pull off these complex behaviors in the first place? This whole thing about phenotypic diversity the paper talks about really caught my eye. Sounds kind of complicated.
Well, think of it this way. Phenotypic diversity basically means that you can have cells with the exact same genes, but they don't express those genes in the same way. So you get these differences in how they look and how they act. Like, imagine you have a box of crayons. You've got a limited number of colors to work with, right? But you can create an almost infinite number of pictures just by how you use those colors together, how much pressure you use, things like that.
Okay, so it's like you have one blueprint, but multiple different outcomes depending on how those genes are expressed. It's like the paper uses that example of Colobacter crescentis. That one really brings the point home, I think.
Oh, yeah. Colobacter is a great example of phenotypic diversity in action. This bacterium, it actually produces two completely distinct daughter cells, a swarmer cell that's swimming all over the place, and a holdfast cell that just stays put attached to a surface. And this whole division of labor, I mean, even at this single cell level, it just shows you how adaptable and how complex these organisms really are.
And that's not even just some weird thing that bacteria do. It's like the same way that stem cells work in multicellular organisms, even in us. Stem cells, just like that Colobacter, they can turn into all sorts of different cell types with their own special functions.
Exactly. When you see that kind of parallel, it makes you think about these deep evolutionary connections.
Yeah.
It suggests that there's something fundamental about how biological systems generate diversity, no matter how different they might seem on the surface. Seems like evolution really likes to hold on to a good strategy, even across huge evolutionary distances.
It's amazing how these basic principles, they just keep popping up all over the place in life, isn't it? But this phenotypic switching, like the paper calls it, that's just one piece of the puzzle, right? What about this whole randomness thing? I mean, the paper also talks about the role of, what was it, molecular noise in how cells act?
Right. So stochastic gene expression, or molecular noise as it's often called, it's basically all the random ups and downs you get in gene expression within a group of cells. It might seem kind of counterintuitive that this randomness would be important, but it turns out it plays a really crucial role in how adaptable and how resilient life is.
So you're saying that even if you have two cells with the exact same DNA, they might still express those genes a little differently just because of this randomness. It's kind of like each cell is rolling the dice to some extent, right? And that creates all these subtle differences within a population.
That's a great way to put it. It's like each cell gets to try out a bunch of different outfits.
You know?
And that randomness, it lets the whole population sample a wider range of these phenotypes. So it increases the odds that you'll have at least a few cells that have the right stuff to handle whatever changes come their way, like diversifying your investments, you know, to protect yourself from the market crashing.
That's a really interesting way to think about it. So randomness, something we usually think of as like a bad thing, as a mistake, it's actually this crucial buffer for life in a world that's constantly changing. Yeah. It kind of challenges that classic view of biology as this perfectly predictable machine, you know? It really highlights how important stochasticity is in shaping how things turn out.
Absolutely. And this stochasticity, it's a key player in all kinds of important stuff, things like bacterial persistence. This is where you have a small number of bacteria that manage to survive even these massive doses of antibiotics. And it's not because they've evolved resistance or anything. It's just pure luck that they happen to be in this temporary state of low activity when the antibiotic hit. This has huge implications for figuring out how infections can stick around and come back even after you hit them with antibiotics.
This whole concept of stochasticity, it really does make you rethink how biology actually works, huh? It's like realizing that even at this most fundamental level, there's this element of chance, of unpredictability, that's driving adaptation and survival. But this is where things get even wilder, right? What about the idea of cells sacrificing themselves so that other cells can benefit? How can that kind of altruism actually be a good thing from an evolutionary perspective? I mean, it seems completely backwards.
Well, it's a question that's had evolutionary biologists scratching their heads for ages. But this paper, it brings up this really compelling explanation with this whole idea of inclusive fitness. Basically, the idea is that even if a cell kicks the bucket, right, if it can help its relatives survive and reproduce better, then those shared genes, they get passed on. So it's like a win in a roundabout way, even though the individual cell is gone.
So it's kind of like this genetic echo where the sacrifice of one cell ends up benefiting its family and keeps those shared genes going strong. The paper uses that example of how heterocysts form in cyanobacteria to explain this whole thing. What's the deal with that?
Oh, cyanobacteria? Those are some cool customers. They're these amazing little guys that can do photosynthesis. But here's the thing. They need oxygen for photosynthesis, obviously, but they also need nitrogen for all these other crucial biological processes. The problem is that the enzyme that fixes nitrogen, it's super sensitive to oxygen.
So it's like they need both water and fire to survive, but those two things, they don't exactly get along, right?
Exactly. It's a real catch-22. But cyanobacteria, they've hit on this ingenious solution. They've got these specialized cells called heterocysts that are different from the regular photosynthetic cells. These heterocysts, they ditch their photosynthetic machinery. They basically say, all right, no more energy production for me.
Talk about taking one for the team, but what's the upside? Why would they evolve to sabotage themselves like that?
Well, think about it. By shutting down photosynthesis, these heterocysts create these little pockets where there's no oxygen. And that's perfect for nitrogen fixation. So you've got this amazing division of labor going on. The heterocysts supply the nitrogen everybody needs, and the other cells, they keep cranking out energy through photosynthesis. Everybody wins.
It's amazing how even at the cellular level, you see this specialization and cooperation leading to something better for everyone. It makes me think of that other thing the paper talked about, this quorum sensing. It's like cells have their own social network or something, constantly chatting and coordinating their moves.
It's true. Quorum sensing is this super cool mechanism that lets cells figure out how crowded it is, how many other cells are around, and then they can adjust their behavior based on that. So it's like they're doing a head count, like, is there enough of us to throw a party? The paper mentioned enzyme secretion is a good example of this.
Oh, yeah, right. Like some of those enzymes, they only really work if you've got a whole bunch of them concentrated in one spot. If it's just a lone cell pumping out those enzymes, it's a waste of energy, right?
Exactly. Total waste. But with quorum sensing, the cells can hold back until they've got the numbers. Then it's like, all right, everyone release the enzymes. And you get this big coordinated effect that's way more powerful.
Teamwork makes the dream work, as they say. The paper also talked about how quorum sensing is involved in building that DNA uptake machinery, right? Which, now that I think about it, only makes sense if there's a bunch of free-floating DNA around in the first place. It's all about being resourceful.
Absolutely. Constructing all that molecular machinery to grab onto DNA and pull it inside, that takes a lot of energy. So it wouldn't make sense for a cell to do that unless it knew there was a good chance of actually snagging some DNA. Quorum sensing lets the cells check how much DNA is out there, and they only build the machinery when it's worth it. Smart, huh?
It's like waiting for a sale before you stock up on something, right? But this whole system, this cooperation, it seems like it would be pretty easy for someone to take advantage of, doesn't it? What's to stop some rogue cells from just reaping the benefits without pulling their weight?
You've hit the nail on the head.
Yeah.
Just like any society where you've got cooperation, these bacterial communities, they've got their fair share of cheaters. Cells that figure out how to game the system. It's like this never-ending arms race, you know? You've got mechanisms evolving to cheat, and then you've got other mechanisms evolving to stop the cheaters.
So even at the microscopic level, we see the same kind of social dilemmas that we grapple with in our own lives. It kind of makes you realize that evolution isn't about reaching some perfect state of harmony or anything. It's more like this constant push and pull, this dance between cooperation and competition. Speaking of cooperation, let's talk about those transient metazoans, those slime molds, that Dictyostelium discoideum the paper talks about. That thing sounds like something straight out of a sci-fi movie.
Slime molds, they're definitely some of the more mind-bending creatures out there. They really blur the lines between what we think of as single-celled and multicellular life. When there's plenty of food around, Dictyostelium, it just hangs out as these single-celled amoebas, just doing their own thing, living the good life.
Living their best single-celled life. I like it. But when things start to get a little rough, that's when things get really interesting.
Tell me about it. When food starts running low, these little amoebas, they start sending out these chemical distress signals, like they're putting out an SOS. Hey, everybody, things are getting real out here. Time to team up.
Like a microscopic bat signal calling all cells.
Exactly. And this chemical call to action, it's mostly driven by this molecule called CAMP. It sets off this amazing transformation. All these individual amoebas, they start clumping together, and they form this slug-like thing that can actually move in a coordinated way. This little slug, it can actually crawl to a better location, which increases the odds that the whole group will survive.
Wow, so they go from being all on their own to this organized multicellular organism, and it's all because of a few chemical signals and the shared need to survive. These slime molds, they don't mess around.
No, they don't. But wait, there's more. This slug, it's not just wandering around aimlessly. It's got a goal. It's got to disperse its spores so that the next generation can keep on going.
And I'm guessing that this is where we get to some more cellular self-sacrifice. These guys really seem to have that whole take one for the team mentality down pat. You got it.
Okay.
When this slime mold slug is ready to spread those spores, some of the cells, they basically volunteer as tribute, you know? They turn into this strong stalk that lifts up the other cells, the ones that actually carry the spores, so they have a better shot at getting out there and surviving.
It's kind of poetic when you think about it, isn't it? This beautiful act of cellular altruism. It shows you that even these temporary multicellular organisms, they've got this incredible division of labor going on, this willingness to sacrifice themselves so the group can succeed. It's really remarkable.
It really makes you rethink these ideas we have about individuality and cooperation, doesn't it? It's like they're right on the edge between being a single-celled organism and something more complex, and it gives you these little hints about how that big leap to permanent multicellularity might have actually happened.
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? How did we go from these single cells to these big, complicated life forms like us? The paper points to this time period called the Cryogenian. Things were pretty wild back then. Lots of climate swings and crazy environmental changes. Seems like that could have been the perfect recipe for this big evolutionary jump.
So like this pressure cooker for evolution, forcing life to get more complex, to cooperate more, just to make it out alive. I remember the paper talked about two main theories about what might have been the driving force behind this whole thing, right?
Right. So one idea is all about dodging predators. Imagine you're a tiny little predator and you're trying to snag yourself a single cell for dinner. Piece of cake, right? But what if, instead of one cell, you come across this big clump of them all stuck together?
Suddenly you're trying to swallow a mouthful of marbles instead of one grape. I don't think that's ending well for the predator.
Exactly. Multicellularity, it's like putting on a suit of armor.
Yeah.
It makes it way harder for predators to just gobble these cells up.
Yeah.
And the cool thing is, there's actually some solid evidence to back this up. They did this experiment where they exposed this single-celled alga to a predator. And guess what? The alga started evolving multicellularity super fast. They formed these clusters that were way too big for the predator to handle.
That's evolution in action right there. Talk about a strong motivation to adapt or die. Yeah. But it's not just about avoiding becoming someone else's snack, right? Sure. I mean, the paper also mentioned this idea that becoming multicellular opened up all these new doors for life, new opportunities. Like, it allowed for this level of specialization and complexity that you just can't get with a single cell, right?
Exactly. It's like, when you've got all these cells working together, they can divide and conquer. They can become specialists in different tasks, which makes a whole organism way more efficient, way more able to take advantage of new resources. Think about it like human societies, right? We've got all these different people with different skills and jobs, yeah. And that's what allows us to be so productive and interconnected.
So it's like, instead of a one-man band where the pool guy is trying to play all the instruments at once, you've got this whole orchestra, each musician bringing their own unique talents to create this rich, amazing sound.
Love that analogy.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this really cool experiment with yeast that illustrates this point perfectly. The paper mentions it. Basically, they found that if you just select for yeast cells that don't fully separate after they divide, they start forming these multicellular clusters they called snowflakes. Now, these snowflakes, they're not exactly what we'd think of as true multicellular organisms, but they still show you how just a small tweak in how cells behave can lead to these big changes in size and complexity.
It's like evolution's a tinkerer, isn't it? Always messing around with what's already there and coming up with these elegant solutions. But these yeast snowflakes, they're still missing something pretty crucial that you see in true multicellular organisms like us, right?
You got it. When we talk about true multicellularity, like in plants and animals, a big part of that is having a germline. That's a specialized group of cells that are only there to pass on genetic information. So you got this division of labor. The somatic cells, they handle the everyday business of living. And the germ cells, they're focused on making the next generation. That's kind of the hallmark of more advanced multicellular life.
Wow, this whole deep dive has really been eye-opening. It's amazing to think about all the cool stuff that's happening at the cellular level, all these social strategies they've come up with, from sacrificing themselves to working together in these incredible ways. It's like we got a sneak peek behind the curtain evolution, you know. We got to see that constant struggle between competition and cooperation, that drive to survive that's at the heart of it all.
Absolutely. And I think if there's one big takeaway here, it's that even the tiniest units of life, these cells we hardly ever think about, they're capable of these incredible things. Cooperation, communication, even selflessness. It really makes you wonder, you know, if they can pull that off, what does it say about the potential for collaboration and innovation in more complex systems, even in our own lives? It's a pretty inspiring thought to end on, I'd say.
I couldn't agree more. Well, that's about all the time we have for today's deep dive. Thanks for joining us on this incredible journey into the world of cellular social strategies. Until next time.